We give our attention then to God's own word, John 13, reading together verses 1 through 17. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And supper being ended, the devil having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" Jesus answered and said to him, "What I am doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you." For he knew who would betray him. Therefore he said, "You are not all clean." So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, he said to them, "Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, 'Well, for so I am.' If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Beloved congregation of the Lord Jesus Christ, we read just a few moments ago from Belgic Confession, Article 19, a article which seeks to explain the union and distinction of the two natures in the person of Christ. And perhaps as we read that article a few moments ago, you weren't terribly excited about the sermon tonight. This is heavy theology. And in the early church, there was much discussion and much debate upon these very issues. And church councils were held and creeds were drafted. And indeed, this is heavy theology. And it's very easy, I think, for us to think that it has very little relevance for us, that it's not very practical, that it's not very helpful. But as we look at John 13 together tonight, a passage in which we see something of the union and distinction of the two natures in the person of Christ, it's my prayer that we'll see that this is indeed something that is very relevant to us, that it is something that is very helpful to us, that it is something that is indeed very practical for us. And John begins this scene here in chapter 13 in the opening verses by pointing us to the love of Jesus for his own. And you notice the way in which it's communicated to us in these verses. It is the love of the Lord for his own. Look at verse 1. Before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And just a word about the setting here. This is just before the Passover, that great feast of the Jews, that great feast of the Old Testament, that feast in which they celebrated God's deliverance of them by the blood of the Lamb. And so John has in view here the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. And John is reminding us here at the beginning of John 13, as they are sitting there in the upper room, that already the shadow of the cross is looming large upon this scene. And he points us to something of the divinity of Jesus, something of the Godhead of Jesus. He knows that his hour has come, that hour in which he will depart from this world to the Father. And while Jesus certainly loves his Father and longs to be with him, he also knows the path he must take to return to his Father. Jesus knows that the shadow of the cross is looming large over him now. He knows all of the suffering that is before him, the false accusations that will be made in only a matter of hours. He knows the insults that will be hurled upon him. He knows the mockery that he will endure. He knows the beating that he will suffer at the hands of the soldiers. He knows the whipping that is coming, the thorns that will be pressed into his brow, the nails that will fasten him to the tree, the nakedness that he will bear before all the world to see, the shame and the utter forsakenness. He knows that what lies before him is nothing less than the unmitigated and relentless wrath of a holy God. He knows he is about to be forsaken. He knows that he is about to enter the agonies and the torments of hell. And he knows he will suffer those agonies and those torments more fully than any inhabitant of hell ever can or ever will, because he suffers them in the place of others. He has no sin. What he is doing, he's doing for you and me. He's about to enter all of these things, and yet he is steadfast. And notice what John emphasizes about his steadfastness here in verse 1. He is steadfast in his love for his own. The agonies of hell cannot deter him from his love for his own. The wrath of a holy God cannot deter him from loving his own. Always he has loved his own who were in the world, and now we are told he loved them to the end. And John is doing something here most beautiful in this text. The word that is used here in chapter 13 and verse 1, where it says he loved them to the end, is the Greek word telos. He loved them to the end. He loved them to the telos. And a very similar word will be spoken by Jesus the very next day when he hangs upon the cross. One of his final words on the cross, the sixth cross word, Jesus will say in chapter 19 and verse 30, tetelestai, which means it is finished. It is ended. These words in the Greek are related to each other, and so what is being said here in John 13 verse 1 is related to what is going to be said in chapter 19 verse 30. Jesus has loved his own all the way up to John 13 verse 1, and he will love them all the way to the end in chapter 19 and verse 30. In other words, to put it very plainly, there is never a point from the time Jesus enters the upper room to the moment he breathes his last upon the cross. There is not so much as a moment that he stops loving his own. There are no second thoughts. There are no regrets. There is no moment upon the cross as he is enduring all of it that he wishes he hadn't done this. He loves them to the end. Now remember who this is. This is Jesus, the Son of God. God of God, light of light, very God of very God, begotten, not made, being of one substance with the Father, by whom all things were made. This is the Lord. And he knows all things. and remember who he loves. He loves sinners who are going to deny him that very night. Sinners who are going to flee from him in just a matter of hours and run away from him. They would not stand with him in the hour of his greatest need, when all the while he is absolutely and unwaveringly committed to us in our greatest need. And what a contrast we see then as we move into verse 2. In verse 1, we see something of the love of the Lord, a love that leads him to humble himself, as we read in Philippians 2, even to the bitter and shameful death of the cross. And what a contrast we see now in verse 2, where we see the devil and we see Judas Iscariot not humbling themselves, but exalting themselves in pride. Supper being ended, John writes, the devil having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. They've just eaten a meal together, a fellowship meal, a meal of communion. But something sinister has happened during that meal, and if not during that meal, then just before that meal, and if it happened before the meal, it would make what is happening here all the more heinous still. The devil has put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot to betray Jesus. Here's a meal of fellowship, and here's Satan working through Judas to destroy that fellowship. Here is Jesus loving his own, and here is Satan, and now Judas hating Jesus. Jesus is Lord, and he humbles himself to serve in love. Satan is not Lord, but he wants to be. And so he exalts himself in pride and leads Judas to do the same. And Jesus knows it. He knows all things. Remember who he is. He is very God. And John points us again to something of the majesty of Jesus, even there in that upper room, verse 3. You perhaps are familiar with the painting of Leonardo da Vinci at the Last Supper. Here is Jesus at the Last Supper, but even da Vinci, as wonderful as an artist as he was, could not capture the majesty of Jesus that John records for us here in the Word. Look at verse 3. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going to God. Again, there is this emphasis upon the divinity of Jesus, upon his Godhead, upon the fact that he knows all things. And John says here that the Father, Jesus knows that the Father has given all things into his hands. This is a remarkable statement. This is not after the resurrection. This is not in those moments before the ascension where Jesus says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. This is before his death on the cross. And already Jesus knows that all things are in his hands. Even as Jesus sits there in the upper room at the table, he is the sovereign. He is the one who is upholding all of creation. He's the one who's giving life and breath to all those disciples in that room. Even to Judas. Apart from him, no one can do anything. Not Judas. Not even the devil. All things are in Jesus' hands, and he knows it. And so we are reminded of what John writes earlier in his gospel. No one can take Jesus' life from him. He lays it down of his own accord. He knows that he has come from God. He knows that he is going to God. But before he does so, he does something most exquisite, something most profound, something most beautiful, something that reveals his heart, something that reveals him as Lord and servant. Look at verses 4 and 5. And remember the context. Jesus knows all that is going on here. He knows he is God. He is Lord. And yet he is a Lord who serves. Verse 4, he rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Supper's ended. And Jesus rises up. And he rises up to do something. He rises up to lay aside his garments. And it's striking here once again, John's choice of words, the very same word is used here as Jesus lays aside his garments, the very same word that Jesus himself used in John chapter 10 and verse 11 and verse 15 and verse 17 and verse 18, where Jesus said, I lay down my life. Same word. So that what Jesus is doing here in the upper room as he lays aside his garments is this. He is giving a picture of what he's going to do in laying down his life on the cross. You see, the shadow of the cross is here. This is the Lord who has come to serve. He laid down his garments and girded himself with a towel. He poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that he had girded around his waist. There is something profoundly wrong about this entire scene, isn't there? It should have been the other way around. It should have been the disciples washing Jesus' feet. But up until this hour, no one has washed anyone's feet. They've eaten the entire supper there in the upper room with dirty feet because there was not a single one among them who had stooped down to such a low and menial task. This was the responsibility, after all, of servants and even of slaves. But in that upper room that night, there was no servant except one. And that one servant was the Lord of all. The Lord of all is the only one who will stoop to serve all. And you picture him there going around the table one by one, taking each one of his disciples, stinking, smelling, filthy, dirty feet into his hands to wash them. They hadn't walked all day on clean, swept roads. They had walked on dirty and dusty roads in a city that didn't have the sewer systems that we have today, and roads that were filled not with automobiles but with animals. And you get the point. Their feet were dirty. They were dusty. Who knows what they had stepped in? Well, Jesus knew. And with his hands, those very hands that would be nailed to the cross the next day, with those very hands, he took each one of their feet in his hands and washed them. Washed around the ankles and scrubbed off their heels and washed the bottom of their feet and the tops of their feet and washed between each one of their toes and went from one disciple to the next and did this. He has taken the form of a servant. He has girded himself with humility. And he's doing this there in the upper room. He's making his way around the table. But then there is an interruption when he comes to Peter. Evidently, none of the other disciples said a thing. They simply let Jesus wash their feet. But then in verses 6 and following, Jesus comes to Peter, and Peter instinctively realizes the absurdity of this scene. He calls Jesus Lord in verse 6. Lord, are you washing my feet? At least he understands this is something that should never be. Jesus, with great patience and humility, ministers to Peter in verse 7 and says, what I'm doing now you do not understand, but you will know after this. But Peter still objects. Verse 8, you shall never wash my feet. And Peter does not relent until Jesus says to him, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. To which Peter replies, verse 9, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. You see, Peter doesn't get it. He gets enough to know that he wants to have a part with Jesus, but he still has so very much to learn. First, he didn't want Jesus to wash his feet. Now, he wants Jesus to wash his hands and his head as well as his feet. And you see what's common to both of Peter's statements. He doesn't rely on the sufficiency of what Jesus is doing. First, he wants no part of what Jesus is doing. And then he errs completely on the other side and wants more than what Jesus is doing. And what's common to both of Peter's objections is this: a dissatisfaction with Jesus' service. Peter still has so very much to learn. And that becomes clear in Jesus' response. Look at verse 11. He knew who would betray him. Therefore, he said, you are not all clean. I want you to notice something here. We don't have the time to develop it tonight, but notice here in this interchange, verses 6 through 11, what John has done as he has recorded the scene, he has placed Peter and Judas Iscariot very, very close to each other. And if you read John 13 through 19 carefully, you'll see John doing this time and time again, putting Judas Iscariot and Peter right next to each other. There is not much separating them. In the end, what separates them is Christ. Peter, though so nearly overcome by the darkness, even here in the upper room, still by God's grace wants a part with Jesus, even though this very night he'll deny it. Judas, of course, wants no part. It's only a few moments now before Judas departs into the darkness of night. Peter comes so close to that night. He comes so close to that darkness. The darkness almost encompasses him. And yet, by God's grace, at the end, you know the rest of the story, how Peter is drawn again to the light. But in a few moments, Judas will leave. He'll leave into the darkness of night to betray Jesus. But don't miss this. He leaves with clean feet. Feet washed by the hands of Jesus. Jesus has served him. Even Judas. He has offered himself to Judas to the very last. And how beautifully and exquisitely he's done so. This is the heart of the Lord for sinners. And it should say to each one of us loudly and clearly that there is no sinner beyond the reach of his grace. Even Judas had his feet washed. Well, we come to verse 12. We need to wrap things up quickly here. Verse 12, when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, he said to them, "Do you know what I've done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, 'Well, for so I am.' If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them." And notice once again in verse 12, when he had washed their feet, taken up his garments. Jesus takes up his garments again. And even as we read in John 10 that Jesus laid down his life, we read also in John 10 that he takes up his life again. Same word in the Greek. Jesus is giving here in John 13 not only a foreshadowing of his death on the cross in verses 1 through 11, but he is giving us also, beginning in verse 12, a foreshadowing of his resurrection from the dead. Did you notice the language? He washed their feet. He took up his garments. He sat down again. Isn't this what Jesus will do? He will rise up from the dead. He will ascend into heaven, clothed with the glory that he has earned. He will take it with him into heaven. And what does he do from heaven? He pours out his life to his people. By his Spirit, he conforms us to his image and makes us like himself. And so here in verse 12, what has Jesus done? He has left them all clean. He has taken all of their dirt to himself. All of their dirt is now on the towel he wore. It's a picture of what he'll do on the cross. But notice what he does with that towel. He puts it aside again. There comes a point when sin is paid for, and Jesus himself bears it no more. And he takes up his garments, and he is clothed in glory. But this is still a foreshadowing. And it's a foreshadowing because by the end of all of this, as you come to verse 12, there is only one person in that entire room whose feet are still dirty. And that's Jesus. No one has washed his feet. But then, he did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. And the fact that it is the Lord who serves makes this all the more beautiful. I want to draw your attention as we close this evening to one statement there from Belgic Confession, Article 19. And then apply it to this wonderful passage in John 13. We read in that article that the divine nature always remained united with the human, even when he lay in the grave. Even as Jesus' body was there in the grave, the divine nature was united to him. And the Godhead did not cease to be in him any more than it did when he was an infant, though it did not so clearly manifest itself for a while. Now you take that statement, the divine nature always remained united with the human. And you apply that here to John 13. And you understand the point. This was none other than God in the flesh washing the feet of sinners. He is not just fully man. He is fully God. Do you see something of the heart of our God? something of his attitude towards sinners, something of the way in which he is both Lord and servant. Isn't there something so incredibly attractive in all of this? What Jesus is doing here as full God and full man. And if you see something attractive in all of this, then know this, Jesus, even by this act, is drawing you to himself. And when he draws us to himself, he gives us the life that is in him. And that's why you have verses 13 through 17. Serving one another should never be beneath us. Are you so attracted by how Christ has served you that you are looking to serve others, not only in the church, but even outside of the church? Remembering that while God doesn't need your good works, your neighbor does. Jesus has given us an example here. But there is so much more than an example. He is Lord and servant. He did not use his divinity for his own benefit, but for ours. And what can our response possibly be but to look upon this love so amazing, so divine, and confess that it demands our soul, our life, our all. Amen.